from Sir John MacDonald and the Minister of Justice in Ottawa. Isn't that wonderful?" She clasped her hands, and at that moment she looked like a child, although a large and ugly one, gazing at a beautiful gift. She was one of those who never did believe me to be guilty, being soft-hearted and of a sentimental nature. At this news I put down my sewing. I felt very cold all at once, as if I was about to faint, which I hadn't done for a long time, ever since you left, sir. "Can it be true?" I said. If it was another person, I would have thought she might be playing a cruel joke on me, but Janet did not relish jokes of any kind. "Yes," she said. "It is really true. You are pardoned. I am so happy for you." I could see that she felt some tears were in order, and I shed several. That night, and even though her father, the warden, didn't have the paper actually in hand, but only a letter about it, nothing would do but that I had to be moved out of my prison cell and into the spare bedroom at the warden's house. This was the doing of Janet, the good soul, but she had the assistance of her mother, as my pardon was indeed an unusual event in the dull routine of the prison, and people like to have some contact with events of that sort, so they can talk about them to their friends afterwards. So I was made a fuss of. After I'd blown out my candle, I lay in the best bed, wearing one of Janet's cotton nightdresses instead of the coarse yellowy prison one, and looking up at the dark ceiling. I tossed and turned, and somehow I couldn't get comfortable. I guess comfort is what you're accustomed to, and by that time I was more accustomed to my narrow prison bed than to a spare bedroom with clean sheets. The room was so large it was almost frightening to me, and I pulled the sheet up over my head to make it darker. And then I felt as if my face was dissolving and turning into someone else's face, and I recalled my poor mother in her shroud as they were sliding her into the sea, and how I thought she had already changed inside the sheet and was a different woman. And now the same thing was happening to me. Of course, I wasn't dying, but it was in a way similar. The next day at breakfast, the warden's whole family sat beaming at me with moist eyes, as if I was some rare and cherished thing, like a baby snatched out of a river. And the warden said we should give thanks for the one lost lamb that had been rescued, and they all said a fervent amen. That is it, I thought. I have been rescued, and now I must act like someone who has been rescued, and so I tried. It was very strange to realize that I would not be a celebrated murderess any more, but seen, perhaps, as an innocent woman wrongly accused and imprisoned unjustly, or at least for too long a time, and an object of pity rather than of horror and fear. It took me some days to get used to the idea. Indeed, I am not quite used to it yet. It calls for a different arrangement of the face, but I suppose it will become easier in time. Of course, to those who do not know my story, I will not be anybody in particular. After breakfast on that day, I was strangely dejected. Janet noticed it and asked me why, and I said, "I've been in this prison now for almost 29 years. I have no friends or family outside it. And where am I to go, and what am I to do? I have no money, nor any means of earning any, and no proper clothing, and I am unlikely to obtain a situation anywhere in the vicinity, as my story is too well known, because, despite the pardon, which is all very well, a mistress in any right-thinking family would not want me in the house, as she would be afraid for the safety of her loved ones. It is only what I would do myself in their position." I did not say to her, "And I am also too old to go on the town," as I did not wish to shock her, she having been well brought up and a Methodist. Though I must tell you, sir, the thought did cross my mind. But what chance would I have at my age and with so much competition? It would be a penny a time with the worst drunken sailors up an alley somewhere, and I'd be dead of disease within a year, and it made my heart fail even to consider it. So now, instead of seeming my passport to liberty, the pardon appeared to me as a death sentence. I was to be turned out into the streets alone and friendless, to starve and freeze to death in a cold corner, with nothing but the clothes on my back, the ones I'd come into the prison with. And perhaps not even those, as I had no idea what had become of them. For all I knew, they had been sold or given away long ago. "Oh, no, dear Grace," said Janet. "All that has been thought of. I did not want to tell you everything at once, as we feared the shock of such happiness coming after such misery might be too much for you. It sometimes has that effect. But a good home has been provided for you. It is in the United States. And once you have gone there, you may leave the sad past behind you, as no one there need ever know about it. It will be a new life. She did not use exactly these words, but that was the gist of it. But what am I to wear? Said I, still in despair. Perhaps I was indeed unsettled in my wits, as a person altogether in her right mind would have asked first about the good home that was being provided, and where it was, and what I was to do there. I thought later about the way she had put it. A good home provided, it is what you would say of a dog or a horse that is too old to work any more, and that you don't wish to keep yourself or have put down. I have thought of that too, said Janet. She was really a most helpful creature. I have looked in the storage rooms, and by some miracle the box you brought with you was still in there with your name on a label. I suppose it is because of all the petitions that were got up in your favor after the trial. They may have kept your things at first because they thought you were soon to be released, and then after that they must have forgotten all about it. I will have it brought up to your room, and then we will open it, shall we? I felt a little comforted, although I did have some misgivings, and I was right to have them, for when we opened the box we found that the moths had been in and had eaten up the woolens, my mother's thick winter shawl among them, and some of the other things were much discolored and musty-smelling from being shut up for so long in a dampish place. The threads in some were almost rotted through, and you could put your hand right through them. Any piece of cloth needs a good airing every once in a while, and these had been given none. We took everything out and spread the things around the room to see what could be saved. There were Nancy's dresses, so pretty when fresh, now for the most part ruined, and the things I'd had from Mary Whitney. I'd prized them so much at the time, and now they looked shoddy and outmoded. There was the dress I'd made at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's with the bone buttons from Jeremiah, but nothing could be saved of it except the buttons. I found the piece of Mary's hair, tied with a thread and wrapped up in a handkerchief as I'd left it. But the moths had been into that, too. They will eat hair if nothing better is left, and it is not stored in cedar. The emotions I experienced were strong and painful. The room seemed to darken, and I could almost see Nancy and Mary beginning to take shape again inside their clothes, only it was not a pleasant notion, as by now they themselves would be in much the same dilapidated state. I felt quite faint and had to sit down and ask for a glass of water, and for the window to be opened. Janet herself was taken aback. She was too young to have realized what the effects of 29 years shut up in a box might be, although she made the best of it according to her nature. She said that in any case the dresses were now sadly out of fashion, and we could not have me going to my new life looking like a scarecrow, but that some of the things could yet be used, such as the red flannel petticoat and some of the white ones, which could be washed in vinegar to get rid of the smell of mildew, and then bleached in the sun, and they would come out white as anything. This was not quite the case, as once we had done it they were indeed lighter in color, but not what you would call white. As for the other things, she said, we would have to look about us. I would need a wardrobe, she said. I do not know how it was done. I suspect she begged a dress from her mother, and went around among her acquaintance and collected up some other things, and I do believe the governor contributed the money for the stockings and shoes. But at the end she'd gathered together a store of garments. I found the colors overbright, such as a green print, and a broadcloth with stripes in a magenta tone on a sky blue. It was the new chemical dyes that are now in use. These colors didn't exactly suit me, but beggars can't be choosers, as I've learned on many occasions. The two of us sat together and made the dresses over to fit. We were like a mother and daughter working on a trousseau, very friendly and cozy, and after a time I was quite cheered up. My only regret was the crinolines. They'd gone out of fashion, and now it was all wire bustles and big bunches of cloth pulled to the back with ruchings and fringes, more like a sofa to my mind, and so I never would have the chance to wear a crinoline. But we cannot have everything in this life. Bonnets were gone, too. Now it was all hats tied under the chin and quite flat and tilted forward like a ship sailing on top of your head, with veils floating out behind them like the wake. Janet obtained one for me, and I did feel queer the first time I put it on and looked in the mirror. It did not cover my streaks of gray hair, although Janet said I looked 10 years younger than I really was, almost a girl, in fact. And it's true that I'd kept my figure and most of my teeth. She said I looked a real lady, which is possible, as there is less difference in dress between maid and mistress now than there used to be, and the fashions are easily copied. We had a merry enough time trimming the hat with silk flowers and bows, though several times I broke down in tears because I was overwrought. A change in fortune often has that effect, from bad to good as well as the other way around, as I'm sure you have noticed in life, sir. As we were packing and folding, I snipped some pieces out of the various dresses I'd worn long ago, but which were now to be discarded, and I asked if I might have a prison nightdress of the sort I was accustomed to sleep in, as a keepsake. Janet said she thought it a strange keepsake, but she made the request for me, and it was granted. I needed something of my own to take away with me, you see. When all was ready, I thanked Janet with deep gratitude. I was still fearful of what was to come, but at least I would look like an ordinary person, and no one would stare. And that is worth a great deal. Janet gave me a pair of summer gloves, almost new. I don't know where she got them. And then she began to cry. And when I asked her why she was doing that, she said it was because I was to have a happy ending, and it was just like a book. And I wondered what book she'd been reading. August the 7th of 1872 was the day of my departure, and I will never forget it as long as I live. After breakfast with the warden's family, at which I could scarcely eat anything, I was so nervous, I put on the dress I was to travel in, the green one, with a straw hat trimmed to match and the gloves Janet had given me. My box was packed. It was not Nancy's box, as that one smelled too much of mildew, but another one provided by the penitentiary, leather, and not much worn. It probably belonged to some poor soul who had died there, but I was long past looking a gift horse in the mouth. I was taken in to see the warden. It was a formality, and he did not have much to say, except that he congratulated me upon my release. In any case, he and Janet were to accompany me to the home provided, at the special request of Sir John MacDonald himself, as it was intended I should get there safely, and they knew perfectly well I wasn't accustomed to modern modes of travel, having been so long shut away. And also there were many rough men about, discharged soldiers from the Civil War, some crippled, and others with no means of support, and I might be in some danger from them. So I was very glad for the company. I passed through the gates of the penitentiary for the last time as the clock struck noon, and it went through my head like a thousand bells. Until that instant I couldn't quite trust my senses. While dressing for the journey, I'd felt more numb than anything, and the objects around me appeared flat and lacking in color. But now, all sprang to life. The sun was shining, and every stone of the wall seemed as clear as glass, and lighted up like a lamp. It was like passing through the gates of hell and into paradise. I do believe the two are located closer together than most people think. Outside the gates there was a chestnut tree, and each leaf of it seemed rimmed by fire. And sitting in the tree, there were three white pigeons, which shone like the angels of Pentecost. And at that moment I knew I had truly been set free. At such times of more than ordinary brightness or darkness, I used to faint. But on this day, I asked Janet for her smelling salts, and so remained upright, although leaning on her arm, and she said it would not have been in nature for me to have remained unmoved on such a momentous occasion. I wished to turn and look back, but I remembered Lot's wife and the pillar of salt, and refrained from doing so. To look back would also have meant that I regretted my departure and had a wish to return, and this was certainly not the case, as you may imagine, sir. But you will be surprised to hear me say that I did indeed have a sort of regret, for although the penitentiary was not exactly a homey place, yet it was the only home I'd known for almost 30 years, and that is a long time, longer than many people spend on this earth, and although it was forbidding and a place of sorrow and punishment, at least I knew its ways. To go from a familiar thing, however undesirable, into the unknown, is always a matter for apprehension. And I suppose that is why so many people are afraid to die. After this moment, I was back again in ordinary daylight, although light-headed. It was a hot and humid day, such as the climate beside the lake produces in August. But as there was a breeze coming off the water, the weather was not too oppressive. There were some clouds, but only the white kind that do not foretell rain or thunder. Janet had a parasol which she held over both of us as we proceeded. A parasol was one item I lacked, as the silk of Nancy's pink one had all rotted away. We went to the railway station in a light carriage driven by the warden's servant. The train was not due to leave until 1:30, but I was anxious about being late, and once there could not sit quietly in the ladies' waiting room, but had to walk up and down the platform outside, as I was very agitated. Finally the train drew in, a large, shining, iron monster puffing smoke. I'd never seen a train so close up. And although Janet assured me it was not dangerous, I had to be assisted up the steps. We took the train as far as Cornwall, but though it was a short enough journey, I felt I should never survive it. The noise was so loud, and the motion so rapid, I thought I would go deaf. And there was a great deal of black smoke, and the blowing of the train whistle startled me nearly out of my wits, although I took hold of myself and did not scream. I felt better when we descended at the Cornwall station, and went from there to the docks in a pony trap, and took a ferry across the end of the lake, as that form of travel was more familiar to me and I could get some fresh air. The motion of the sunlight on the waves was, at first, bewildering to me, but this effect ceased when I stopped looking at it. Refreshment was offered, which the warden had brought with him in a basket, and I managed to eat a little cold chicken and drink some lukewarm tea. I occupied my mind with looking at the costumes of the ladies on board, which were varied and brightly colored. Sitting down and standing up, I had some trouble managing my bustle, as a thing like that takes practice, and I'm afraid I wasn't overly graceful. It was like having another bum tied on top of your real one, and the two of them following you around like a tin bucket tied to a pig, although of course I did not say anything so coarse to Janet. On the other side of the lake, we passed through the Customs House of the United States, and the warden said we had nothing to declare. Then we took another train, and I was glad the warden had come, as otherwise I would not have known what to do about the porters and luggage. While we were sitting on this new train, which rattled less than the previous one, I asked Janet about my final destination. We were going to Ithaca, New York, that much I'd been told. But what would happen to me after that? What was the home provided to be like, and was I to be a servant in it? And if so, what had the household there been told about me? I didn't wish to be placed in a false position, you see, sir, or expected to conceal the truth about my past. Janet said that there was a surprise awaiting me, and as it was a secret, she could not tell me what it was, but it was a good surprise, or so she hoped it would be. She went so far as to tell me it concerned a man, a gentleman, she said, but as she was in the habit of using this term of anything in trousers above the station of a waiter, I was not any the wiser. When I said, "What gentleman?" she said she couldn't tell, but he was an old friend of mine, or so she'd been given to understand. She became very coy, and I couldn't get another word out of her. I thought back over all the men it might be. I hadn't known very many of these, not having had the chance, you might say. And the two I'd perhaps known the best, although by no means the longest, were dead, by which I mean Mr. Kinnear and James McDermott. There was Jeremiah, the peddler, but I did not think he would be in the business of providing good homes, as he had never seen the domestic type. There were also my former employers, such as Mr. Coates and Mr. Harrigy, but surely by now all were either dead themselves or very elderly. The only other one I could think of, sir, was you yourself. I must admit that the idea did cross my mind. And so it was with anxiety but also expectation that I descended at last onto the station platform at Ithaca. There was a crush of people meeting the train and all talking at once, and the hustling of the porters and the many trunks and boxes being carried and wheeled about on carts made it hazardous to stand there. I held on tightly to Janet while the warden arranged about the luggage, and then he conducted us to the other side of the station building, the side away from the trains, where he began to look about him. He frowned at not finding what he expected, and glanced at his watch and at the station clock, and then he consulted a letter which he took from his pocket, and my heart began to sink. But he looked up and smiled and said, "Here's our man," and there was indeed a man hurrying towards us. He was above the average height, and bulky, but lanky at the same time, by which I mean that his arms and legs were long, but he had a more solid and rounder middle part to him. He had red hair and a large red beard, and was wearing a black suit of the Sunday best kind that most men have now, if they are at all comfortable in worldly goods, with a white shirt and a dark stock, and a tall hat which he was carrying in his hands, held in front of him like a shield, by which I could tell that he too was apprehensive. He wasn't a man I'd ever seen before in my life, but as soon as he came up to us, he gave me a searching glance and then flopped onto his knees at my feet. He seized my hand, glove and all, and said, "Grace, Grace, can you ever forgive me?" Indeed, he almost shouted it, as if he'd been practicing it for some time. I struggled to pull my hand away, thinking he was a madman. But when I turned to Janet for help, she was in a flood of sentimental tears, and the warden was beaming away as if he had hoped for nothing better, and I saw that I was the only one who was completely at sea. The man let go of my hand and stood up. "She doesn't know me," he said sadly. "Grace, don't you know me? I would have known you anywhere." And I looked at him, and there was indeed something a little familiar about him, but still I could not place it. And then he said, "It's Jamie Walsh." And I saw that it was. We then repaired to a new hotel close to the railway station, where the warden had arranged accommodations, and partook together of some refreshments. As you may imagine, sir, a good deal of explanation was then required, for the last time I'd seen Jamie Walsh was at my own trial for murder, when it was his testimony that turned the minds of the judge and jury so much against me for the wearing of a dead woman's clothes. Mr. Walsh, for so I will now call him, proceeded to tell me that he'd thought at the time I was guilty, although he hadn't wished to think so, as he'd always had a liking for me, which was true enough. But as he'd grown older and had considered the matter, he'd come to be of the opposite persuasion, and had been overcome with guilt for the part he'd played in my conviction, though he was only a young lad at the time and no match for the lawyers who'd led him into saying things he did not see the results of until afterwards. And I was consoling to him, and said it was the sort of thing that could happen to anyone. After Mr. Kinnear's death, he and his father were forced to leave the property, as the new owners had no use for them, and he took a position in Toronto, which he obtained due to his having made such a good impression as a bright and up-and-coming lad at the trial, which is what they wrote about him in the newspapers. So you might say he got his start in life on account of me, and he saved up his money for several years and then went to the States, as he was of the opinion that there was more opportunity for becoming a self-made man down there. You were what you had, not what you'd come from, and few questions asked. He worked on the railroads and also out west, saving all the while, and now owned his own farm and two horses, all complete. He took care to mention the horses early on, as he knew how fond I once was of Charlie. He had married, but was now a widower with no children, and he'd never ceased to be tormented by what had become of me through him, and had written several times to the penitentiary to see how I was getting on, but he did not write direct to me, as he did not wish to upset me. And it was in this way that he heard of my pardon and arranged matters with the warden. The upshot was that he begged me to forgive him, which I did readily. I did not feel I could hold a grudge, and told him I would no doubt have been put in prison anyway, even if he hadn't mentioned Nancy's dresses. And when we had gone through all of that, he pressing my hand the whole time, he asked me to marry him. He said that although not a millionaire, he could certainly offer me a good home, with all that might be required, as he had some money put by in the bank. I made a show of hanging back, though the reality of it was that I did not have many other choices, and it would have been most ungrateful of me to have said no, as so much trouble had been taken. I said I did not want him to marry me out of mere duty and guiltiness, and he denied that such were his motives, and claimed that he'd always had very warm feelings towards me, and that I'd scarcely changed at all from the way I was as a young woman. I was still a fine looker, was how he put it. And I remembered the daisies in Mr. Kinnear's orchard with the stumps. and I knew he did think that. The hardest thing for me was viewing him as a full-grown man, as I'd known him only as the gawky lad who'd played the flute the night before Nancy died and was sitting on the fence the very first day I came to Mr. Kinnear's. Finally, I said yes. He had the ring all ready, in a box in his vest pocket, and he was so overcome with emotion that he dropped it twice onto the tablecloth before putting it on my finger, for which I had to remove my glove. Matters for the wedding were arranged as quickly as possible, and we remained at the hotel meanwhile, with hot water brought to the room every morning, and Janet stayed with me as being more proper. All was paid by Mr. Walsh, and we had a simple ceremony with a justice of the peace, and I remembered Aunt Pauline saying so many years ago that I would no doubt marry beneath me, and wondered what she would think now. And Janet stood bridesmaid and cried. Mr. Walsh's beard was very large and red, but I assured myself that it could be altered in time. It is almost 30 years to the day since when, not yet 16 years of age, I first went up the long driveway to Mr. Kinnear's. It was June then as well. Now I am sitting on my own veranda in my own rocking chair. It is late afternoon, and the scene before me is so peaceful you would think it was a picture. The roses at the front of the house are in bloom. Lady Hamilton's they are, and very fine, although subject to aphids. The best thing, they say, is to dust them with arsenic. But I do not like to have such a thing about the house. The last of the peonies are flowering, a pink and white variety and very full of petals. I don't know the name, as I did not plant them. Their scent reminds me of the soap that Mr. Kinnear used for shaving. The front of our house faces southwest, and the sunlight is warm and golden, although I do not sit right in it, as it is bad for the complexion. On such days I think, this is like heaven. Although heaven was not a place I ever used to think of myself as going. I have been married to Mr. Walsh for almost a year now, and although it is not what most girls imagine when young, that is perhaps for the better, as at least the two of us know what sort of a bargain we have got into. When people marry young, they often change as they grow older, but as the two of us have already grown older, there will not be as much disappointment in store. An older man has a character already formed, and is not as likely to take to drink or other vices, because if he was going to do such a thing, he would have done it by now, or that is my opinion, and I hope that time will prove me right. I have prevailed on Mr. Walsh to trim his beard somewhat, and to indulge his pipe-smoking only out of doors, and in time perhaps both of these things, the beard and the pipe too, will disappear altogether. But it's never a good idea to nag and push a man, as it only makes them the more obstinate. Mr. Walsh does not chew tobacco and spit, as some do, and as always I am grateful for small mercies. Our house is an ordinary farmhouse, white in color, and with shutters painted green, but commodious enough for us. It has a front hall with a row of hooks for coats in the winter, although mostly we use the kitchen door, and a staircase with a plain banister. At the head of the stairs is a cedar chest for the storage of quilts and blankets. There are 4 upstairs rooms, a little one intended for a nursery, then the main bedchamber, and another in case of guests, although we neither expect nor wish any, and a 4th, which is empty at present. The 2 furnished bedchambers each have a washstand, and each has an oval braided rug, as I don't want heavy carpets. They're too difficult to drag down the stairs and beat in spring, which would be worse as I get older. There is a cross-stitch picture over each bed, which I did myself, flowers in a vase in the best room, and fruit in a bowl in ours. The quilt in the best room is a wheel of mystery, the one in ours a log cabin. I bought them at a sale, from people who'd failed and were moving west, but I felt sorry for the woman and so paid more than I should. There have been a great many things to be seen to in order to make everything cozy, since Mr. Walsh had developed bachelor's habits after the death of his first wife, and some things had become none too savory. I had a large array of cobwebs and hanks of sluts wool to sweep out from under the beds, and also a fair deal of scrubbing and scouring to do. The summer curtains in both bedchambers are white. I like a white curtain myself. Downstairs we have a front parlor with a stove, and a kitchen with a pantry and scullery all complete, and the pump inside the house, which is a great advantage in winter. There is a dining room, but we don't have that sort of company very often. For the most part, we eat at the kitchen table. We have 2 kerosene lamps, and it is very snug there. I use the dining room table for sewing, which is especially handy when cutting out the patterns. I have a sewing machine now, which is worked by a handwheel and is just like magic. And I am certainly glad to have it, as it saves a great deal of labor, especially for the plain sewing, such as the making of curtains and the hemming of sheets. I still prefer to do the finer sewing by hand, although my eyes are not what they used to be. In addition to what I have described, we have the usual, a kitchen garden with herbs and cabbages and root vegetables, and peas in the spring, and hens and ducks, cow and barn, and a buggy and 2 horses, Charlie and Nell, who are a great pleasure to me, and good company when Mr. Walsh is not here. But Charlie has worked too hard, as he is the plow horse. They say there are machines coming in soon that will do all of that sort of work, and if so, then poor Charlie can be turned out to pasture. I would never let him be sold for glue and dog meat, as is the habit of some. There is a hired man who helps on the farm, but he doesn't live on the premises. Mr. Walsh wanted to employ a girl as well, but I said I would prefer to do the work of the house myself. I don't want to have a servant living in, as they pry too much and listen at doors. And also it's much easier for me to do a task right myself the first time than to have someone else do it wrong and then do it over. Our cat is named Tabby. She is the color you might expect, and a good mouser. And our dog is named Rex. He is a setter and not bright, although well-meaning, and the most beautiful shade of reddish-brown, like a polished chestnut. These are not very original names, but we don't wish to get a reputation in the neighborhood for being too original. We attend the local Methodist church, and the preacher is a lively one, and fond of a little hellfire on Sundays. However, I do not think he has any notion of what hell is really like, no more than the congregation. They are worthy souls, though narrow. But we have thought it best not to reveal too much of the past, to them or anyone, as it would only lead to curiosity and gossip, and thence to false rumors. We've given out that Mr. Walsh was my childhood sweetheart, and that I married another, but was lately widowed, and that since Mr. Walsh's wife died, we arranged to meet again and to marry. That is a story easily accepted, and it has the advantage of being romantic and of causing pain to no one. Our little church is very local and old-fashioned, but in Ithaca itself they are more up-to-date and have a good number of spiritualists there, with celebrated mediums coming through and staying at the best homes. I don't go in for any of that, as you never know what might come out of it. And if I wish to commune with the dead, I can do it well enough on my own. And besides, I fear there is a great deal of cheating and deception. In April, I saw one of the celebrated mediums advertised, a man with a picture of him. And though the picture was printed very dark, I thought, that must be Jeremiah the peddler. And indeed it was. As Mr. Walsh and I had occasion to drive into town for some errands and shopping, and I passed him on the street. He was more elegantly dressed than ever, with his hair black again and his beard trimmed in the military fashion, which must inspire confidence, and his name is Mr. Gerald Bridges now. He was doing a very good imitation of a man who is distinguished and at home in the world, but with his mind on the higher truth. And he saw me, too, and recognized me, and gave a respectful tip of the hat, but very slight, so it wouldn't be remarked, and also a wink. And I waved my hand at him, just a little, in its glove, as I always wear gloves to town. Fortunately, Mr. Walsh did not notice either of these things, as it would have alarmed him. I would not wish any here to learn my true name, but I know my secrets are safe with Jeremiah, as his are safe with me. And I remember the time I might have run away with him, and become a gypsy, or a medical clairvoyant, as I was certainly tempted to do. And in that case my fate would have been very different. But only God knows whether it would have been better or worse, and I have now done all the running away I have time for in this life. On the whole, Mr. Walsh and I agree, and things go on very well with us. But there is something that has troubled me, sir, And as I have no close woman friend I can trust, I'm telling you about it, and I know you will keep the confidence. It is this. Every once in a while, Mr. Walsh becomes very sad. He takes hold of my hand and gazes at me with the tears in his eyes, and he says, "To think of the sufferings I have caused you." I tell him he did not cause me any sufferings. It was others that caused them, and also having plain bad luck and bad judgment. But he likes to think it was him that was the author of all, and I believe he would claim the death of my poor mother, too, if he could think of a way to do it. He likes to picture the sufferings as well, and nothing will do but that I have to tell him some story or other about being in the penitentiary, or else the lunatic asylum in Toronto. The more watery I make the soup, and the more rancid the cheese, and the worse I make the coarse talk and the proddings of the keepers, the better he likes it. He listens to all of that like a child listening to a fairy tale, as if it is something wonderful. And then he begs me to tell him yet more. If I put in the chilled lanes and the shivering at night under the thin blanket, and the whipping if you complained, he is in raptures. And if I add the improper behavior of Dr. Bannerling towards me, and the cold baths, naked and wrapped in a sheet, and the straight waistcoat in the darkened room, he is almost in ecstasies. But his favorite part of the story is when poor James McDermott was hauling me around the house at Mr. Kinnear's, looking for a bed fit for his wicked purposes, with Nancy and Mr. Kinnear lying dead in the cellar, and me almost out of my wits with terror, and he blames himself that he wasn't there to rescue me. I myself would as soon forget about that portion of my life, rather than dwelling on it in such a mournful way. It's true that I liked the time when you were at the penitentiary, sir, as it did make a break in my days, which were mostly the same then. Now that I come to think of it, you were as eager as Mr. Walsh is to hear about my sufferings and my hardships in life. And not only that, but you would write them down as well. I could tell when your interest was slacking, as your gaze would wander, but it gave me joy every time I managed to come up with something that would interest you. Your cheeks would flush, and you would smile like the sun on the parlor clock. And if you'd had ears like a dog, they would have pricked forward, with your eyes shining and your tongue hanging out, as if you'd found a grouse in a bush. It did make me feel I was of some use in this world, although I never quite saw what you were aiming at in all of it. As for Mr. Walsh, after I have told him a few stories of torment and misery, he clasps me in his arms and strokes my hair and begins to unbutton my nightgown, as these scenes often take place at night. And he says, "Will you ever forgive me?" At first this annoyed me very much, although I did not say so. The truth is that very few understand the truth about forgiveness. It is not the culprits who need to be forgiven. Rather, it is the victims, because they are the ones who cause all the trouble. If they were only less weak and careless and more foresightful, and if they would keep from blundering into difficulties, think of all the sorrow in the world that would be spared. I had a rage in my heart for many years against Mary Whitney, and especially against Nancy Montgomery, against the two of them both, for letting themselves be done to death in the way they did, and for leaving me behind with the full weight of it. For a long time I could not find it in me to pardon them. It would be much better if Mr. Walsh would forgive me, rather than being so stubborn about it and wanting to have it the wrong way around. But perhaps in time he will come to see things in a truer light. When he first began this, I said I had nothing to forgive him for, and he shouldn't worry his head about it. But that wasn't the answer he wanted. He insists on being forgiven. He can't seem to go on comfortably without it. And who am I to refuse him such a simple thing? So now every time this happens, I say, "I forgive him." I put my hands on his head as if in a book, and I turn my eyes up and look solemn, and then kiss him and cry a little. And then after I've forgiven him, he is back to his usual self the next day, playing on his flute as if he's a boy again, and I am 15, and we are out in the orchard making daisy chains at Mr. Kinnear's. But I don't feel quite right about it, forgiving him like that, because I am aware that in doing so I am telling a lie. No, I suppose it isn't the first lie I've told. But as Mary Whitney used to say, A little white lie such as the angels tell is a small price to pay for peace and quiet. I think of Mary Whitney frequently these days, and of the time we threw the apple peelings over our shoulders, and it has all come true after a fashion. Just as she said, I married a man whose name begins with a J, and as she also said, I first had to cross over water 3 times, since it was twice on the ferry to Lewiston, going and coming back, and then once again on the way here. Sometimes I dream that I am again in my small bedchamber at Mr. Kinnear's, before all the horror and tragedy. And I feel so safe there, not knowing what is to come. And sometimes I dream that I am still in the penitentiary, and that I will wake to find myself once more locked in my cell, shivering on the straw mattress on a cold winter morning, with the keepers laughing outside in the yard. But I am really here, in my own house, in my own chair, sitting on the veranda. I open and shut my eyes and pinch myself. But it remains true. Now, here is another thing I have told no one. I'd just had my 45th birthday when I was let out of the penitentiary, and in less than a month I will be 46, and I'd thought I was well past the time for childbearing. But unless I am much mistaken, I am now 3 months gone. Either that, or it is the change of life. It is hard to believe, but there has been one miracle in my life already, so why should I be surprised if there is another? Such things are told of in the Bible, and perhaps God has taken it into his mind to make up a little for all I was put through at a younger age. But then it might as easily be a tumor, such as killed my poor mother at last, for although there is a heaviness, I've had no sickness in the mornings. It is strange to know you carry within yourself either a life or a death, but not to know which one. Though all could be resolved by consulting a doctor, I am most reluctant to take such a step. So, I suppose time alone must tell. While I am sitting out on the veranda in the afternoons, I sew away at the quilt I am making. Although I've made many quilts in my day, this is the first one I have ever done for myself. It is a tree of paradise. But I am changing the pattern a little to suit my own ideas. I've thought a good deal about you and your apple, sir, and the riddle you once made, the very first time that we met. I didn't understand you then, but it must have been that you were trying to teach me something, and perhaps by now I have guessed it. The way I understand things, the Bible may have been thought out by God, but it was written down by men. And like everything men write down, such as the newspapers, they got the main story right, but some of the details wrong. The pattern of this quilt is called the Tree of Paradise, and whoever named that pattern said better than she knew, as the Bible does not say trees. It says there were 2 different trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge, but I believe there was only one, and that the fruit of life and the fruit of good and evil were the same. And if you ate of it, you would die. But if you didn't eat of it, you would die also. Although, if you did eat of it, you would be less bone ignorant by the time you got around to your death. Such an arrangement would appear to be more the way life is. I am telling this to no one but you, as I am aware it is not the approved reading. On my tree of paradise, I intend to put a border of snakes entwined. They will look like vines or just a cable pattern to others, as I will make the eyes very small. But they will be snakes to me, as without a snake or two, the main part of the story would be missing. Some who use this pattern make several trees, 4 or more in a square or circle, but I am making just 1 large tree on a background of white. The tree itself is of triangles in 2 colors, dark for the leaves and a lighter color for the fruits. I am using purple for the leaves and red for the fruits. They have many bright colors now with the chemical dyes that have come in, and I think it will turn out very pretty. But 3 of the triangles in my tree will be different. 1 will be white, from the petticoat I still have that was Mary Whitney's. 1 will be faded yellowish, from the prison nightdress I begged as a keepsake when I left there. And the 3rd will be a pale cotton, a pink and white floral, cut from the dress of Nancy's that she had on that first day I was at Mr. Kinnear's, and that I wore on the ferry to Lewiston when I was running away. I will embroider around each one of them with red feather stitching, to blend them in as a part of the pattern. And so, we will all be together. Author's afterword. Alias Grace is a work of fiction, although it is based on reality. Its central figure, Grace Marks, was one of the most notorious Canadian women of the 1840s, having been convicted of murder at the age of 16. The Kinnear-Montgomery murders took place on July 23, 1843, and were extensively reported not only in Canadian newspapers, but in those of the United States and Britain. The details were sensational. Grace Marks was uncommonly pretty, and also extremely young. Kinnear's housekeeper, Nancy Montgomery, had previously given birth to an illegitimate child and was Thomas Kinnear's mistress. At her autopsy, she was found to be pregnant. Grace and her fellow servant, James McDermott, had run away to the United States together and were assumed by the press to be lovers. The combination of sex, violence, and the deplorable insubordination of the lower classes was most attractive to the journalists of the day. The trial was held in early November. Only the Kinnear murder was tried. Since both of the accused were condemned to death, a trial for the Montgomery murder was considered unnecessary. McDermott was hanged in front of a huge crowd on November 21st, but opinion about Grace was divided from the start, and due to the efforts of her lawyer, Kenneth McKenzie, and a group of respectable gentlemen petitioners who pleaded her youth, the weakness of her sex, and her supposed witlessness, her sentence was commuted to life, and she entered the provincial penitentiary in Kingston on November 19, 1843. She continued to be written about over the course of the century, and she continued to polarize opinion. Attitudes toward her reflected contemporary ambiguity about the nature of women. Was Grace a female fiend and temptress, the instigator of the crime and the real murderer of Nancy Montgomery? Or was she an unwilling victim, forced to keep silent by McDermott's threats and by fear for her own life? It was no help that she herself gave three different versions of the Montgomery murder, while James McDermott gave two. I first encountered the story of Grace Marks through Susanna Moody's Life in the Clearings, 1853. Moody was already known as the author of Roughing It in the Bush, a discouraging account of pioneering life in what was then Upper Canada and is now Ontario. Its sequel, Life in the Clearings, was intended to show the more civilized side of Canada West, as it had by then become, and included admiring descriptions of both the provincial penitentiary in Kingston and the lunatic asylum in Toronto. Such public institutions were visited like zoos, and at both Moody asked to see the star attraction, Grace Marks. Moody's retelling of the murder is a third-hand account. In it, she identifies Grace as the prime mover, driven by love for Thomas Kinnear and jealousy of Nancy, and using the promise of sexual favors to egg McDermott on. McDermott is portrayed as besotted by her and easily manipulated. Moody can't resist the potential for literary melodrama, and the cutting of Nancy's body into four quarters is not only pure invention, but pure Harrison Ainsworth. The influence of Dickens' Oliver Twist, a favorite of Moody's, is evident in the tale of the bloodshot eyes that were said to be haunting Grace Marks. Shortly after she saw Grace in the penitentiary, Susanna Moody encountered her in the lunatic asylum in Toronto, where she was confined on the violent ward. Moody's first-hand observations are generally trustworthy, so if she reports a shrieking, capering Grace, that is no doubt what she saw. However, soon after the publication of Moody's book, and just after the appointment of the humane Joseph Workman as medical superintendent of the asylum, Grace was considered sane enough to be returned to the penitentiary, where, records show, she was suspected of having become pregnant during her absence. This was a false alarm, but who at the asylum could have been the supposed perpetrator? The wards of the asylum were segregated. The men with the easiest access to the female patients were the doctors. Over the next two decades, Grace turns up in the penitentiary records from time to time. She was certainly literate, as the warden's journal depicts her as writing letters. She so impressed a good many respectable persons, clergymen among them, that they worked tirelessly on her behalf and submitted many petitions aimed at securing her release, seeking medical opinion to bolster their case. Two writers state that she was a trusted servant for many years in the home of the governor, probably the governor of the penitentiary, although the admittedly incomplete prison records do not mention this. However, it was the custom of the time in North America to hire out prisoners for day labor. In 1872, Grace Marks was finally granted a pardon. Records show that she went to New York State accompanied by the warden and his daughter to a home provided. Later writers claim that she married there, although no proof of this exists, and after this date all trace of her vanishes. Whether she was indeed the co-murderer of Nancy Montgomery and the lover of James McDermott is far from clear, nor whether she was ever genuinely insane, or only acting that way, as many did, to secure better conditions for herself. The true character of the historical Grace Marks remains an enigma. Thomas Kinnear appears to have come from a lowland Scots family from Kinloch, near Cooper, in Fife, and to have been the younger half-brother of the heir to the estate, although, strangely, a late 19th-century edition of Burke's Peerage lists him as having died about the same time as he turned up in Canada West. The Kinnear House in Richmond Hill remained standing until late in the century and was a point of interest for sightseers. Simon Jordan's visit to it is based on an account by one of them. The graves of Thomas Kinnear and Nancy Montgomery are in the Presbyterian Churchyard in Richmond Hill, although unmarked. William Harrison, writing in 1908, reports that the wooden pickets around them were taken down at a time when all wooden markers were removed. Nancy's rosebush has similarly disappeared. Some further notes. Details of prison and asylum life are drawn from available records. Most of the words in Dr. Workman's letter are his own. Dr. Bannerling expresses opinions that were attributed to Dr. Workman after his death, but which could not possibly have been his. The design of the Parkinson residence has a great deal in common with that of Dundurn Castle in Hamilton, Ontario. Lott Street in Toronto was formerly the name of a portion of Queen Street. The economic history of Loomisville and its treatment of mill girls loosely echoes that of Lowell, Massachusetts. The fate of Mary Whitney has a parallel in the medical records of Dr. Langstaff of Richmond Hill. The spiritualist craze in North America began in Upper New York State at the end of the 1840s with the rappings of the Fox sisters, who were originally from Belleville, where Susanna Moody was by then resident, and where she became a convert to spiritualism. Although it soon attracted a number of charlatans, the movement spread rapidly and was at its height in the late 1850s, being especially strong in upstate New York and in the Kingston-Belleville area. Spiritualism was the one quasi-religious activity of the times in which women were allowed a position of power, albeit a dubious one, as they themselves were assumed to be mere conduits of the spirit will. Mesmerism was discredited as a reputable scientific procedure early in the century, but was widely practiced by questionable showmen in the 1840s. As James Braid's neurohypnotism, which did away with the idea of a magnetic fluid, mesmerism began a return to respectability, and by the 1850s had gained some following among European doctors, although not yet the wide acceptance as a psychiatric technique that it was to achieve in the last decades of the century. The rapid generation of new theories of mental illness was a characteristic of the mid-19th century, as was the creation of clinics and asylums, both public and private. There was intense curiosity and excitement about phenomena such as memory and amnesia, somnambulism, hysteria, trance states, nervous diseases, and the import of dreams among scientists and writers alike. The medical interest in dreams was so widespread that even a country doctor such as James Langstaff was recording the dreams of his patients. Dissociation of personality, or dedoublement, was described early in the century. It was being seriously debated in the 1840s, although it achieved a much greater vogue in the last three decades of the century. I have attempted to ground Dr. Simon Jordan's speculations in contemporary ideas that would have been available to him. I have, of course, fictionalized historical events, as did many commentators on this case who claim to be writing history. I have not changed any known facts, although the written accounts are so contradictory that few facts emerge as unequivocally known. Was Grace milking the cow or gathering chives when Nancy was hit with the axe? Why was Kinnear's corpse wearing McDermott's shirt? And where did McDermott get that shirt, from a peddler or from an army friend? How did the blood-covered book or magazine get into Nancy's bed? Which of several possible Kenneth Mackenzies was the lawyer in question? When in doubt, I have tried to choose the most likely possibility while accommodating all possibilities wherever feasible. Where mere hints and outright gaps exist in the records, I have felt free to invent.